Valentine's Day. Well, Sri Aurobindo, somewhere in the 1920s, in conversation with a group of people sitting about him, made an observation about his work in the Arya, that the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of integral knowledge, had too many chapters in it. Should have been simplified. The yoga of divine love should have been expanded upon. He never had a chance to come back to it. But that following section in the synthesis of yoga, which began with the principle of the integral yoga, which we start tonight, published on 15th December 1918, would run about 2 years more and then would cease. The reasons he never stated clearly for why he set down the Arya, but in these early chapters, he makes it clear what the idea is about a synthetic yoga, an integral yoga. So it's worth our time to go back through, even if we don't do the entire section of essays, 2 years worth of essays, to look at the leading motifs which he enters into in these first couple of chapters. So I propose to you that from now to the end of the year, we'll work in the yoga of self-perfection, and come January, take up essays on the Gita. So, chapter one, the principle of the integral yoga. The principle of yoga is the turning of one or of all powers of our human existence into a means of reaching divine being. In an ordinary yoga, one main power of being, or one group of its powers, is made the means, vehicle, path. In a synthetic yoga, all powers will be combined and included in the transmuting instrumentation. And this we see from his earliest writings about his personal approach to the practice of yoga as he arrived in Pondicherry and received an afflatus from above as to what it was that he should do and what became his cave of tapasya. All parts of the nature would come together collectively to realize and dynamize the divine being, the divine consciousness, the divine bliss. Indeed, it was a life-affirming project, but based on a reversal and a conversion of all the elements of our being. We're not simply meant to live the life as given to us, but to transform it, to return it to its origin, to live a more noble and a truer existence. So now he looks at the best known of the yogas, those which represent elementally the various aspects of our being. And interestingly, he begins with our base. We start from the body. In Hatha Yoga, the instrument is the body and life. Hatha means forceful, so it is the forceful yoga. Hatha Pradipika, the main text which came into being, oh, say, 700, 800 years ago, if memory serves, was itself a synthetic document. The earliest materials we have about Hatha Yoga probably carry us back to Buddhist Tantra. But by the time it has become a purely Indian product, its synthetic approach through tantric ideas has brought together a number of different theories, including Vedantic, including Raja Yogic. And so Swatmarama, as he organized these ideas into the Hatha Pradipika, was himself establishing an early attempt at integration. So in Hatha Yoga, the instrument is the body and life. Instrument of what? Instrument of the soul, ultimately. All the power of the body is stilled, collected, purified, heightened, concentrated to its utmost limits or beyond any limits by asana and other physical processes. The power of the life, too, is similarly purified, heightened, concentrated by asana and pranayama. So yes, you begin to see that we are leading from step to step in this, that just as the Yoga Sutras describe the ascent of being beginning with our consciousness focused on establishing stillness in the body in a seated posture and then regulating our breath, and we bring purification to our being both inwardly in how we govern our thoughts and emotions and outwardly in how we deal with the world and society around us, and lift ourselves from level to level until we can withdraw our consciousness from externalities and focus on fundamentals. So, this concentration of powers is then directed towards that physical center in which the divine consciousness sits concealed in the human body. Yes, Hatha Yoga is going to stir that sleeping energy and force it out of its torpor. This place of concentration is the Muladhara chakra, the root chakra. The power of life, nature power, coiled up with all its secret forces asleep in the lowest nervous plexus of the earth being, for only so much escapes into waking action in our normal operations as is sufficient for the limited uses of human life, rises, awakened through center after center, and awakens too in its ascent and passage the forces of each successive notice of our being, the nervous life, the heart of emotion and ordinary mentality, the speech, sight, will, the higher knowledge, till through and above the brain, it meets with and it becomes one with the divine consciousness. So he has called this the power of life. It's an ascending force that traces the course of evolution from the beginning in the body all the way to the topmost mind. It may think it's regal, it may think it's king, but the body is the base. And without it, no yoga is possible. He moves on. In Raja Yoga, the chosen instrument is the mind. And of course, we all think of Raja Yoga as being connected with Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, but there are other texts which treat Raja Yoga as well. Not simply the Yoga Sutras, and not first the Yoga Sutras. Our ordinary mentality is first disciplined, purified, and directed towards the divine being, then by a summary process of asana and pranayama, the physical force of our being is stilled and concentrated, the life force released into a rhythmic movement capable of cessation and concentrated into a higher power of its upward action. The mind, supported and strengthened by this greater action and concentration of the body and life upon which it rests, is itself purified of all its unrest and emotion and its habitual thought waves, liberated from distraction and dispersion, given its highest force of concentration, gathered up into a trance of absorption. So this is a wonderful sentence, isn't it? It's a rather lengthy sentence, and he's covered the whole broad scheme of raising the mind into awareness of the divine. Note that as with the body, with asana and pranayama and hatha yoga, here too, there is a gathering of the being, forcing upon it stillness. Don't let the mind wander. Focus it. Concentrated. The life energy is required. You have to apply prana, force, to be able to sustain that concentration, and slowly it lifts you upwards, and there you go, climbing rung by rung. And ultimately, that purity, that focus, that dharana, concentration, delivers you into samadhi, a trance of absorption. Samadhi, where you're conscious simply of the divine being, no longer simply of confusing externalities, distractions claiming your attention from the senses or from half-forgotten emotions or from compelling thoughts. Two objects, the one temporal, the other eternal, are gained by this discipline. Mind power develops in another concentrated action. Abnormal capacities of knowledge, effective will, deep light of reception, powerful light of thought radiation, which are altogether beyond the narrow range of our normal mentality. It arrives at the yogic or occult powers around which there's been woven so much quite dispensable and yet perhaps salutary mystery. So why would we refrain from these powers? Is a question Sri Aurobindo asks from time to time in Synthesis of Yoga and later in his Letters on Yoga, letters that were shared with the disciples gathered around him primarily in Pondicherry in the ashram. So, not simply the power of sight, but the power to receive from around, from the universe, and draw into one's ken knowledge about the world, power to receive anaphlatus from above and capture diviner and diviner lights as they become reachable, but also the power to radiate outwards your thought. Sri Aurobindo has in many places spoken about how in his sadhana he was able to influence world events through concentrated pressure from his realized consciousness upon things moving in the world. So these siddhis, these powers of perfection, have a utility in our temporal life. He continues, but the one final end and the one all-important gain is that the mind, stilled and cast into a concentrated trance, can lose itself in the divine consciousness, and the soul be made free to unite with the divine being. Again, this is samadhi. This is the fusion of the subject and the object, of the drop into the ocean, of the ray back into the sun. It doesn't mean that the individuality of the ray, of the drop, disappears or is canceled and annulled, but it means that the reunion is complete. That one moves and lives as a power within the great power. So now he's looked at the body and the life and the mind, and now he comes to basically the thesis of the 18 chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. The triple way, Trimarga, the triple way takes for its chosen instruments the three main powers of the mental soul life of the human being. Knowledge selects the reason and the mental vision, and it makes them by purification, concentration, and a certain discipline of a God-directed seeking, its means for the greatest knowledge and the greatest vision of all, God knowledge and God vision. So by now we understand that purification, concentration, and self-directed discipline are essential to the practice of yoga wherever you begin. Its aim is to see, know, and be the divine. Works, action, selects for its instrument the will of the doer of works. It makes life an offering of sacrifice to the Godhead, and by purification, concentration, and a certain discipline of subjection to the divine will, a means for contact and increasing unity of the soul of man with the divine master of the universe. Devotion selects the emotional and aesthetic powers of the soul, and by turning them all Godward in a perfect purity, intensity, infinite passion of seeking, makes them a means of God possession in one or many relations of unity with the divine being. All aim in their own way at a union or unity of the human soul with the Supreme Spirit. So each, by suggestion, could become a base, but it is a triple way, so all must be present. One doesn't simply seek the perfection of one part of the being, but calls the other parts forward to combine with and to travel with and to collaborate with all the other parts of the nature. Each yoga, in its process, has the character of the instrument it uses. Thus, the Hatha yogic process is psychophysical, the Raja yogic, mental and psychic. The way of knowledge is spiritual and cognitive, the way of devotion, spiritual, emotional, and aesthetic, the way of works, spiritual and dynamic by action. Each is guided in the ways of its own characteristic power. But all power is in the end one. All power is really soul power. In the ordinary process of life, body and mind, in the ordinary process of life, body and mind, this truth is quite obscured by the dispersed, dividing and distributive action of nature, which is the normal condition of all our functionings, although even there it is in the end evident. For all material energy contains hidden the vital, mental, psychic, spiritual energy, and in the end it must release these forms of the one Shakti. The vital energy conceals and liberates into action all the other forms, the mental, supporting itself on the life and body and their powers and functionings, contains undeveloped or only partially developed the psychic and the spiritual power of the being. But when by yoga, any of these powers is taken up from the dispersed and distributive action, raised to its highest degree, concentrated, it becomes manifest soul power and reveals the essential unity. All power is one, soul power. This is the Chit Shakti, which, however distributed, perhaps endlessly in the world, can return into solidarity, into unity with that which originated it. Therefore, the Hatha yogic process has too its pure psychic and spiritual result. The Raja yogic arrives by psychic means at a spiritual consummation. Let's pause and distinguish here the use of the term psychic from what it will mean after 1926, when Sri Aurobindo, in a sense, reconstructs his scheme of integral yoga and makes the psychic being standing for the Chaitya-purusha, the inmost soul, the spark of the individual divine which resides within us all, the linchpin of the process of the yoga. Psychic here seems to mean inward, that which is not physical. This unity at once suggests the possibility of a synthetic yoga. And what synthesis does is take various elements and combine them into a whole. It brings them together. It unifies. It integrates. Tantric discipline is in its nature a synthesis. It has seized on the large universal truth that there are two poles of being whose essential unity is the secret of existence, Brahman and Shakti, spirit and nature, and that nature is power of the spirit, or rather is spirit as power. Now, there's no finer efflorescence of tantric teaching than that of Abhinavagupta and the whole of what we call the Trika philosophy. So, again, it bears so many comparisons with Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga that it's worth your time to explore that region of Indian philosophy. To raise nature in man into manifest power of spirit is its method, and it is the whole nature that it gathers up for the spiritual conversion. I'll just go on to say that probably the finest living tantric teaching is that of Sri Vidya, which now exists primarily in South India, and what gives it such vigor and such splendor is the fact that it is the repository of the leading thoughts that Abhinavagupta and his associates and followers distilled into their philosophy. So, there you have it. Sri Vidya encapsulates the Trika system, even though it has become Vedanticized according to the light of Advaita thereby. Subject for another evening. It includes in its system of instrumentation the forceful Hatha yogic process, and especially the opening up of the nervous centers and the passage through them of the awakened Shakti on her way to her union with the Brahman. The subtler stress of the Raja Yogic purification, meditation and concentration, the leverage of will force, the motive power of devotion, the key of knowledge. So Sri Aurobindo calls all these pathways into one grand trunk road. All must converge. But it does not stop short with an effective assembling of the different powers of these specific yogas. Not an assembling. He's looking for a harmony of integration. In two directions, it enlarges by its synthetic term the province of the yogic method. First, it lays its hand firmly on many of the main springs of human quality, desire, action, and it subjects them to an intensive discipline with the soul's mastery of its motives as a first aim, and their elevation to a diviner's spiritual level as its final utility. Again, it includes in its objects of yoga not only liberation, mukti, which is the one all-mastering preoccupation of the specific systems, but a cosmic enjoyment, bhukti, of the power of the spirit, which the others may take incidentally on the way, in part, casually, but avoid making a motive or object. It is a bolder and larger system. So, we recover knowledge, chit, and we claim bliss, ananda, for the being, sat chit ananda. I think we will put our bookmark there and finish the chapter next week. We're drawing close to important dates, the 17th of November, the 24th of November, so we call your attention to those. For our reading from Savitri tonight, we turn to Book 1, Canto 3, The Yoga of the King, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. And we'll begin on page 22. A strength of the original permanence, entangled in the moment and its flow, he kept the vision of the vasts behind. A power was in him from the unknowable, an archivist of the symbols of the beyond, a treasurer of superhuman dreams. He bore the stamp of mighty memories and shed their grandiose ray on human life. His days were a long growth to the Supreme, a skyward being nourishing its roots on sustenance from occult spiritual founts, climbed through white rays to meet an unseen sun. His soul lived as eternity's delegate. His mind was like a fire assailing heaven, his will a hunter in the trails of light. An ocean impulse lifted every breath. Each action left the footprints of a god. Each moment was a beat of puissant wings. The little plot of our mortality, touched by this tenant from the heights, became a playground of the living infinite. This bodily appearance is not all. The form deceives. The person is a mask. Hid deep in man, celestial powers can dwell. His fragile ship conveys through the sea of years an incognito of the imperishable. A spirit that is the flame of God abides, a fiery portion of the wonderful, artist of his own beauty and delight, immortal in our mortal poverty. This sculptor of the forms of the infinite, this screened, unrecognized inhabitant, initiate of his own veiled mysteries, hides in a small dumb seed his cosmic thought. In the mute strength of the occult idea, determining predestined shape and act, passenger from life to life, from scale to scale, changing his imaged self from form to form, he regards the icon growing by his gaze, and in the worm foresees the coming God. At last, the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that super life. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Immortally, she conceives herself in him. In the creature, the unveiled creatrix works. Her face is seen through his face, her eyes through his eyes. Her being is his through a vast identity. Then is revealed in man the overt divine. A static oneness and dynamic power descend in him, the integral Godhead seals. His soul and body take that splendid stamp. It's a great passage, isn't it? What a poet, what a seer, what a rishi he is. See you next time. Namaste. Jai Ma.